meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
All right. Good evening, everyone. What we're going to do this evening is talk about how to protect kids. And I don't think there's anything better for us to do here on the program than just that. And I thought I'd bring on two of the best experts that I know. Wendy Murphy, of course, is a former DA, law professor, author of a new book, Injustice for Some. She's also a TV analyst. Robin Sachs is a current Los Angeles County Assistant District Attorney, and she also does TV analyst work. And they're both very good experts, proponents when it comes to child safety, and I thought I'd have them on both at the same time here. Good evening, ladies.
Good evening. Good to be with you again.
Good evening. Hi, Wendy.
Hi, Robin.
You know, just before I came on air, of course, I look at the news stories all the time, and it's so tragic, Wendy. I'm looking at a story actually from around your area, from Cambridge. It says a woman with a history of mental illness purposely walked her young niece and nephew into oncoming traffic on Interstate 495 in Lowell last week. And here we go. You know, I'm looking at a picture of these two beautiful young children who've lost their lives, and, you know, a woman with mental illness. Another story, we're going to talk a little bit about, the schlocky Britney Spears here in a little bit, but here we have another tragedy. It seems like when the, I'm not trying to be rude here, but those with mental illness decide to take themselves, they also take their kids with them, and this is so tragic. Have you heard about the story, and what are your thoughts?
Well, yeah, of course I've heard about the story, and, you're right, Dana, that it seems to be at this point in time, popping up a lot, and I always worry about that. Are there copycats? Is there an incidence rate increase for other reasons? There's a woman down in D.C. who apparently let all of her four children die. We don't know whether she killed them or they just died, and they've been isolated and living with her in an apartment apparently since last spring, and they've been dead since September. Four kids in an apartment. And you come to find out, of course, that she's got serious mental health problems. Andrea Yates, one of the most famous cases, did teach us something, I think. But here's what I don't necessarily understand, and this is just an initial observation. First is, if they're so mentally ill, how come they have this much freedom to be roaming around with kids? And, you know, what are we doing wrong that people who are predisposed to kill themselves or others aren't being watched better, especially if they have children of their own? The second point is, and this is the passing observation, when men kill, because there's lots of cases in the news these days, a guy in Hawaii threw a toddler over the bridge.
Right.
A father killed his four kids and his wife last week. I forget which state that was. We tend to stick the mentally ill label on the moms because it seems so much worse or weirder for a woman to kill, and we're just going to go, well, you know, men, they're sometimes violent, and when they kill, it's just men being men. I actually think men often have mental illness, too, and we just don't see it that way. But I'll just make two points. One is, we have a social services and a protective services agency in every state. And if there's one thing we need to do better, it's recognizing when we have hindsight, whether it's after Andrea Yates' case or some other tragedy, when you get hindsight, you're supposed to then use it as foresight. That's the whole point of hindsight. It's supposed to teach you, so that it doesn't happen again, how to look for those red flags the next time around. We seem not to do that very well. And it's frustrating because every single case you mentioned and the ones that I ticked off, there's no question. You look at the case file and you say, oh, look at all these red flags. Why weren't we looking beforehand is a big question. It's not just about funding. It's about literally getting the right minds in the same room and, you know, not having just one social worker think about a cookie cutter approach to a family with trouble, so that, you know, $1, one family, one kid, one social worker knocks on the door and does this bureaucratic, you know, knock, and then goes home and checks, goes back to the office and checks off a box. I went to the house.
Yep.
What I think we really need, and I'd love to hear Robin's reaction, and then I'll shut up for a second here. What I'd really like to know is, why we don't have, because it's also cost efficient to do it this way, why do we not have more disciplines assigned? So, you know, social worker, law enforcement, lawyer, doctor, why don't we have those types of people having made assessments early on when we see the red flags start to bubble up? Because we know what the high-risk cases look like. They look very different from the low-risk cases. So when we're looking at a family on the verge of a disaster, why don't we have these various disciplines all together sitting in a room saying, let's educate each other about what we each think, and then let's talk about what we can do differently to prevent four kids from dying, or, you know, this woman from walking two children into oncoming traffic. I don't know the answer to why we're not getting it done. Some people will just throw up the, well, we don't have the money flag. I don't think it's that simple. I think, frankly, and this is just my cynicism and my politics, I think it's that children aren't politically relevant enough. They don't vote. They don't have any money. And frankly, we just don't give a damn enough, yes, as a society, about the value of their lives.
You know, Robin, you're knee-deep in this every day. You know, just while I'm looking at this story, another one pops into the news hopper here. It says a man uses household items to torture his stepdaughter to death. We're just hearing more and more about it. You're prosecuting these cases day after day. Wendy makes some very good points. It's a collaborative effort, agencies working together, and the social worker that goes out, knocks on the door, comes home, and checks the box after a 15-minute interview isn't doing their job. Your thoughts on all this?
Well, I have a few thoughts, and Wendy always evokes the best thinking for me, so I enjoy being on a panel with her because I agree with a lot of what Wendy has to say, but there's some other points that I think that we need to keep, to kind of keep the whole thing in perspective. The first thing is that in a great deal of crimes that involve children, there are multidisciplinary approaches to the whole investigation and prosecution of a case, where you'll have a team of people. I work part of the Rape Treatment Center in Los Angeles, part of Stewart House, where I work on a team with the Department of Children and Family Services, law enforcement, medical personnel, therapists, advocates, all together to minimize the amount of trauma to a child and maximize successful prosecution. But the key in that is that it has to be a reported actual prosecution to get to a multidisciplinary team. And many of times with the Department of Children and Family Services, you don't have a crime yet, so that you don't have the other agencies involved, and therefore you lose the benefit of the team. And it's a little bit of what probably Wendy recalls from, you know, her prosecution day, which is, prosecution days, which is, you know, you, someone who goes into, you know, a home and shoots a gun, and just because they have a bad shot, you know, can be filed on for attempted murder, but if they actually have a good shot, they'll be filed on for murder,
right.
But it's the same act, the same intent, it's just they're going to be dealing with potentially less of a crime, less time, and all of that other type of injustice, which doesn't feel right. And I think that that's kind of what happens with the social services and the legal system and the law enforcement all in one, is that you just can't have the resources of everybody involved until there is a crime.
And that's a failure. I understand exactly what you're saying, but I see that as a failure somewhat. And Wendy, you know, your book, Injustice for Some, this hits the nail on the head right here, because what is justice? Is justice after the fact, or is justice before the fact? We're out to protect the kids. Do we have to wait for the crime to be committed, or those that are involved, the social workers, the police officers, investigators, hospitals? You know, the whole Privacy Act thing has gone crazy as far as I'm concerned right now. And we're more worried about litigation than we are worried about consequences in the long term and the safety of some young people. Am I wrong?
Well, no, I think you're right on a really important point, which is that although municipalities and state employees and those who are under the umbrella of responsible for protecting children in a governmental sense when they're being hurt in their home or at risk, they are often immune from liability, or the standard is so high, or there's a cap on liability exposure, that you would expect them to say, I don't care about liability, because we're basically insulated, or it's not that expensive if we do get sued, so I'm just going to care about the kid. But the reverse tends to be true, because they're worried about the front page of the newspaper saying, ah, the social worker did a crappy job. So I think some of the time they're torn between thinking about liability, thinking about the news coverage, and trying to get their job done. But bottom line is, they are always playing defense and the finger in the dike. It, you know, it's the philosophy, it's the attitude, it's the cheap way out that tends to run the machine. So what I like to say is, and I agree with Robin, that the multidisciplinary team approach has been in place for a long time when it comes to prosecution, because you really do want the best case possible for justice, as I would define it in my book, as the post-incident response. You know, what are we going to get truth? Are we going to have a fair result? That, to me, is what justice is. I suppose more philosophically, there's a form of justice that we should care about that is more preventative. I don't know if I would define it as justice. I certainly wouldn't define it as justice in the same way. But the same skill sets are available, and the question is, why aren't we applying those skills before the fact? Because, of course, it's too late if you wait until kids die. It's way too late to do the thing we claim we want to do, which is to prevent the deaths and the serious abuse in the first place. So the one thing I think we're doing a little bit better is measuring risk better. We've been doing it in domestic violence cases in the past 10 years or so, lethality assessments. You know, we don't think that every time a woman gets a restraining order, the man she's accused is just as likely to kill as the next guy. We don't do that anymore, and that's a good thing, because we don't want all the same amount of resources being distributed inefficiently. We want more resources to this guy because he's made threats to kill, he's got a history, you know, he's got other issues, and so we know he's a dangerous guy. We're going to focus on him more. We're going to do more. We're going to butt into his life even before the crime occurs. We're going to knock on his door. We're going to watch him. We might put a GPS tracker on him. He hasn't committed the crime yet, but that's okay, because we see him as a bomb waiting to blow, and we know that now, so there are things we do, and that is the result of a team effort. Lots of disciplines, lots of brains, lots of different kinds of expertise coming to bear on this guy's life, because we're saying to him, we're not going to let you kill her and then bring our multidisciplinary team together to figure out how to lock you up. I think we are sort of doing the same with kids. We're not quite there yet, and I think Robin has a great handle on this other program that's bubbling up all over the country. It was even in place back when I was a prosecutor, so, and I think it's in place in a lot of states. It's called the Child Fatality Review Team. Now, again, it's an after-the-fact analysis, but every time a child dies, these different disciplines sit in the room, they look at the file, they teach each other, they talk to each other, and they say, what could we have done to save this child's life? What were the red flags? What did we miss? Where are the systemic flaws? And then what's good about it is they take that knowledge back to the field and use it to deal with the kids who aren't dead yet. And that's the point. That's the point, that we really do have the capacity, we have the knowledge, we have the bodies willing to work together, which is also really hard. And, you know, the bureaucracies where everybody would rather just take credit for their own work. Now we literally have people saying, I don't care about the territory, I don't care about the competition, I don't care about the glory, I care about kids, so let's work together. That's better than it was even 20 years ago. But at the end of the day, you have to hold the government accountable, in my opinion. When a kid dies and everyone sits around and says, oh, now with hindsight we can see why, we can see what we should have done differently, that to me is unacceptable. And if I were the queen of the world, one thing I would do, because it does matter, money does matter, even to the government, and even when the liability hook is relatively small, the one thing I would do is I would say, you are going to get sued. Someone will sue you. I'm going to change the law so that it is embarrassing and financially painful to you as a person or to you as an agency. You're going to get sued if you don't do your job well. What we have right now is a legal system that almost rewards what I would call the deliberate blindness problem. So if you turn a blind eye to what you see as a high-risk situation, you think that that's going to help protect your agency from embarrassment, because you're always going to be able to say, plausible deniability, I didn't know, I knocked on the door, nobody answered, so I went home, or I went back to the office, I checked off the list. Don't blame me. We have to create a disincentive to do that. We have to switch the incentive patterns around to say, if you think you're going to get a pass because you went to that house, you knew the mentally ill mother was there, you were knocking on the door, there was no answer, these kids were skinny and underfed and dirty when they went to school, and they were scared and they had bruises, and you didn't do your job because you thought you could just say, well, I did my best and then I went home, or I went back to the office, that's going to get you liability exposure. You will have to be proactive. We want you to butt in. We want you to say, this looks and smells and has smoke. I don't want to wait for the fire. And if you don't butt in, you're going to pay through the nose. You're going to pay with social stigma. And we don't do enough of that. We don't punish the inaction enough at all in this country.
Robin, government responsibility, Bill O'Reilly, Wendy Murphy, Jessica's Law, I think 42 states now, that's government responsibility, holding the government's feet to the fire, looking at mandatory minimum sentences, these types of slip-ups that courts have been doing, letting the child predators out, poor sentences, no sentences in some cases, the cop that cares, that wants to actually follow up on something, yet he's got a supervisor saying, you've got five cases backed up, you got to keep working on something. The DA that maybe wants to grab some headlines and wants to push something through or has a busy calendar. Are we doing enough, both in the media and in the system, so to speak, as prosecutors, DAs, policemen, government people, to actually hold all of our feet to the fire to make sure we're doing enough? It's getting better, but I still don't think it's great.
I agree with you. I think we are getting better, and I just want to make one comment in terms of Jessica's Law and stiffer sentencing. It kind of exactly feeds into the point that Wendy was making, that, again, these are still after-the-fact responses.
Yep.
What we do after a crime occurs is a sentence, after someone's been convicted of a sex crime and having people register. That's after we have caught them, prosecuted, and sentenced them. And I think what Wendy's hitting on is a very important point, which is, you know, something that is relevant not just to children, but in terms of, you know, the school violence situations where you look at Cho and Virginia Tech and all of these other things and say all the signs and symptoms were all there too, and 9/11 for that matter. I'm part of a wonderful organization that's developed a computer program that's now an advanced warning system that basically is called Cassandra Capitals, where we utilize a program where we're actually able to go read through blogs and every newspaper and everything and be able to look through the websites and computer to be able to highlight things from a proactive approach as opposed to a reactive approach. And that's such an important aspect to it. Yep. Because I look at things like misdemeanors where, you know, you see a misdemeanor, indecent exposure, and you see a man who's, you know, sitting in front, I've had a case where a man was sitting in front of a 7-Eleven, you know, jacking off in the parking lot right when school was let out, and that person, you know, it's treated like as a misdemeanor, you know, as a just a low-level misdemeanor, and it's given to a brand-new deputy DA, and it's defended by a brand-new public defender. But if you look at someone who's doing that, that's a precursor for, you know, a sexual offender who's going to come back, and if it's not handled correctly, then you're not going to have that prior ability in the future. So you have to treat each of these times that you do have contact with reports and people and live situations as opportunities to do something about it.
If you're just tuning in, I have Wendy Murphy and Robin Sachs here, and we're talking about, I don't think you can find a better topic than this, about how to protect our kids. Wendy, you see the high-profile cases, and when I've done stories on Drew Peterson, and when I've done stories on Britney Spears, and when I've done stories on all these others, the comments that I get back from the listeners and emailers and people on the forum, etc., what about the kids? What about the kids? Are the kids safe? Are the kids safe? I know Britney doesn't have her kids anymore, but she did for a while, driving all over Los Angeles. screaming around. Newspapers, paparazzi, you name it. Drew Peterson, yes, alleged to have committed some crime or a suspect in a crime. He still has his kids. Everyone is worried about the kids, yet is anything being done? And how is this being portrayed in the media? Is it fair what we're doing? Is Drew Peterson being crucified, or are we asking the right questions?
Well, you know, that's a tough question because people say, what about the presumption of innocence? Poor Drew Peterson. And my response, and this is going to sound, I think, offensive to some people, but my response is, I'm not the judge, I'm not the jury, I'm not the government, I don't have to presume his innocence. I actually might want to steer clear of the guy, and if the media didn't give us the information, God forbid he lived in my neighborhood, he could hurt me or my kids. I have a right to know, and I have a right to pass judgment. Just like as I'm sitting here right now, I think O.J. is a murderer,
yep.
And he was acquitted. So, you know, I'm not required to presume his innocence either, even though he's been acquitted. And I think sometimes we forget that there is an important line between the presumption of innocence and the public's right to know and public safety. Look, most people who commit horrible crimes are never charged, and they're walking out there among us. And we have a right to know, no matter whether they're prosecuted successfully or not, we have a right to know so that we can make our own judgments about who we want to spend our time with, who we want to let our children be around, and so forth. If a guy across the street from my house gets indicted for child rape, I'm not sending my kids over for milk and cookies. I don't care. I don't give a damn about the presumption of innocence. I'm not going. So is that fair? You're damn right it's fair, because I have the freedom and the right and the need, frankly, to know and to pass judgment if I'm going to keep my kids safe. What a fool I would be. I'd probably lose my kids if I said, you know, if I sent my kids over and they got molested or raped, and then the social services would take my kids away, and how do you think they'd feel if my response was, well, I was trying to presume the guy's innocence, because, you know, we got to care about the presumption of innocence. They'd lock me up, they'd take my kids away, and they would be right. So are we being fair to Drew Peterson? It's really important to make sure that when the trial comes, and if the trial comes, the jurors who are selected are fair. I don't have to be fair. The jurors have to be fair. And our court system is uniquely qualified to be better than fair to almost all the horrible people who commit terrible deeds in this country. So I'm not worried about that. If anything, I'd like to slap the guy in the face, because he is using the fact that the media is watching him as to his own strategic advantage. Yep. I mean, what was the crap we heard last week about, there's a sighting. There's a Stacey Peterson sighting.
Yep.
You know, probably a PR company was hired to, every time a PR company is hired by a guy who's a suspect or charged in a crime, every single time a PR firm is hired, and I write about this a lot in my book, the nature of this strategy, you know there's going to be a sighting of the missing/dead person next week. We saw it in the Madeleine McCann case. They hired a PR firm. The next thing you know, there's a Madeleine sighting, and I predicted it. I said on one of the programs, you watch, they hired a PR team this week. There's going to be a sighting next week, and there it was. It's very predictable, and it's disgusting because, in a sense, that's a distortion of the truth that really tugs at our heartstrings. You started the question, Dana, by saying people care about the kids. You're damn right we care about the kids. And that sort of emotional wrenching that we go through because we have kids or we care about vulnerable people, whatever the reason we feel connected, that gets exploited all the time, mostly by the bad guy. So should we worry about Drew Peterson's presumption of innocence? Absolutely. Should we feel bad? No. We should be angry that he has the capacity to manipulate the evidence, to manipulate the truth, to literally thumb his nose at the very idea that we should have a way of uncovering what happened. You know, it's very O.J.-esque, in my opinion, what this guy is doing. And the sociopathy that I see in his face, the way he's sort of arrogantly parading around. The one thing I would do differently, again, queen of the world, if I could be the queen of the world tomorrow, the one thing I would do differently in terms of Drew Peterson's case and other cases is, I would say this. If you are a suspect in a case where you are believed to have committed XYZ kinds of crime, I mean serious crimes, I don't care that you're also a good father. You may be father of the year, but if you are suspected or charged with ABC, you lose the kids. Because we have to have a slap. There has to be a little slap when it comes to who we want raising our children. you venture into that dirty underworld of seriously bad criminal behavior, you gotta lose your kids. I mean, Britney Spears lost her kids for what? Britney Spears may have lots of problems. She may be a crummy mother. I don't know. But she didn't rape anybody.
No.
She didn't kill. Okay? Michael Jackson has his children. That's the standard we set. Drew Peterson, Michael Jackson, should not be fathers. Right now, they should not have access to children because they're going to ruin, by virtue of their crappy character, they're going to ruin the lives of the very influential children, very impressionable children that they're spending all their time with. And look who lost their kids. Not Michael Jackson, not Drew Peterson, the in my opinion, repeat killer of his wives, Britney Spears, who's never committed a crime against any human being.
Robin, the cameras in the courtroom, the cases that are being followed. I interviewed Joel Brodsky, Drew Peterson's lawyer, last week, and this discussion turned to the coverage of his case, and he brought up Mark Furman. Mark Furman is working as an analyst for one of the cable news shows and has been going around quasi-investigating this, and he said to me on air, he said, if this ever does go to trial, I can guarantee you that I will bring up Mark Furman's name over and over and over again. Is that a reverse advantage for some of these defense lawyers, Robin, when they see something like that, when they see a Mark Furman who obviously does have a checkered past, who may be asking the right questions, but no matter what he does, he's going to get criticized for it, and as a defense lawyer, you're going to jump on something like that and say there's no way that my client can get a fair trial because Mark Furman was on TV talking about it.
Well, I have actually a couple of responses. First of all, I want to go back to one of the comments that Wendy made, because I think she brings up a good point in terms of putting these guys in the right for citizens to know what's going on. I think that actually when these guys and when Drew Peterson's on TV and he's so narcissistic and disgusting, it actually really shows educated people out there who are watching the news what this person is really like, and ultimately these statements help, I think, in terms of understanding who the police and law enforcement is dealing with. So I kind of took a little bit of a different angle on it, is we can take what they're doing and look, and be able to have, it may be the most view of a statement we may get prior to any sort of arrest and, you know, custody situation. But in terms of, and in terms of the whole Mark Furman thing, I absolutely think, I mean, the defense is going to do anything and everything they can do that they can throw up in the air to see if it's going to stick. So if you can, I mean, if you can throw Mark Furman's name around and mention it, of course it's going to be any sort of advantage to be able to taint the jury pool, move the venue, inconvenience the witnesses, anything. The defense seems to, you know, will never hold back on that opportunity. So you betcha when there is a case where there's anything that has any kind of potential negative slant to it, they're going to use. And it's pathetic, though, in my mind, that Mark Furman reporting is as good as they can get.
Wendy, I know you've got...
I got to say, I like Mark, and I know that he's a mixture of entertainment with good detective skills and this past that hovers over him.
Yeah.
But I just have to say, it's true the defense will use anything and everything, and Robin's right. And prosecutors can't. I mean, let's be clear about the double standard here. A prosecutor has to cross every T, dot every I. They can't even always tell the truth. They have to play by these weird rules that restrain and constrain us. As prosecutors, we have to kind of, you know, present the most banal, cleansed, you know, unemotional presentation of facts. God forbid the jury should actually feel anything for the victim, right? And the defense can throw bombs and play the race card and, you know, do the dog and pony show and lie. And this is the scandal. So, yes, I'm glad to hear that even when someone's trying to be manipulative, like Drew Peterson and O.J. Simpson and Scott Peterson, even when they're using the media and the media is allowing itself to be used and they're lying through their teeth and they have no balls because they know they don't subject themselves to cross-examination or let cops speak with them. No, no, no. They speak to the media. And the media can't cross-examine, doesn't have access to the file, so it's kind of a softball question after softball question. So these wimpy, guys who can't act like real men and just face the music and talk to Robin so she can actually challenge their nonsense, right? They get to distort the truth. Their lawyers get to do all this manipulative stuff. They get to use what I call the expensification strategy, so spend gobs and gobs and gobs of money, making it incredibly difficult for the system to manage, and they get prizes for that. I'm suggesting, and I got to go, but I'll just suggest at the end of my talk, and I'm glad Robin's going to have the whole next 15 minutes alone because I've been a bit of an air hog.
No.
But one of the things I'd like to suggest as a systemic reform measure is that we find a way to punish the nonsense. We require prosecutors to behave super extra, very, 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 very good. You can't do anything wrong, and you get whacked if you do. Defense attorneys do everything beyond the pale, outrageous, false, misleading, nonsense, and they get prizes. That's sick. That's not right. I want every creep to get the best fair trial, but there's no such thing as a constitutional right to lie, to manipulate, to deceive, to trick, to harass, intimidate the witnesses. There's no constitutional right to do that which most attorneys do every day in this country, and that's the thing that bothers me most of all.
Well said, Wendy. We're going to take a break. Thanks, Wendy, for joining us. Of course, the book is And Justice for Some. You'll see the link on our webpage. And,
thank you, too. Bye-bye, Robin. Bye. Take
bye.
Care.
Always a pleasure. We'll be right back here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Robin, just hang on.
It's the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. And now back to the show.
Okay, we're back. Robin Sachs, Deputy District Attorney for Los Angeles County, is still with us. Robin, just carrying on a little bit before we get into something I want to talk to you about called Kids Scene Investigation. I don't know if you saw it. You probably did, but we've talked to Natalie Holloway, you and I, before, and I know you've been on Larry King talking about that case. Did you see the video? And I want to get your perspective as a prosecutor with an open investigation. And we won't get into the whole Aruba thing and is suspect, not suspect, really, all that craziness. There's still a person of interest. I want to be politically correct here. Did you see the video of your aunt taking the glass of wine and throwing it in the face of the TV talk show host? I want to get your perspective first as a district attorney and your thoughts as to if you were representing your aunt and say charges were ever filed against him, did he not just show a whole lot of about himself by throwing that wine in that talk show host's face?
Well, there's no doubt that these guys and people who especially who feel like they've escaped prosecution and feel like they are, you know, have escaped the whole system and the whole process get extremely cocky, and then you really yep. start to see the type of person that you're dealing with. In the United States, the best part about that is something in a murder case where it could be an ongoing investigation where there's no statute of limitations. That would be a very nice picture yep. of who we're dealing with. In Aruba, of course, everything's up in the air.
Yeah, that's just that place is as goofy as it gets. But you know, I was thinking of that when I saw that clown take that wine and throw it in the guy's face. I thought, you know, if I was had you as a person of interest, buddy, you just showed a whole lot about yourself. Anyway, kidsceneinvestigation.com is a link from robinsachs.com. It's something about the little heading here. It says everything I learned about parenting, I learned in court. And you talk about taking your skills as a prosecutor and combining it with a passion for protecting kids. And this brought about Kids Scene Investigation. Tell us about this. This is fascinating.
Thank you. Kids Scene Investigation is actually my website, and the book that I'm writing right now is called Everything I Learned About Parenting, I Learned in Court. And basically, it comes from the premise that really, there are tried and true techniques that we use in trial advocacy all the time. There are basics that we learn in law school and in trial practice that are given. For example, don't ask a question you don't know the answer to, which is kind of the corollary to don't do an experiment that you don't know what the results are. And you can, and if you remember in the OJ case, you'll recall Chris Darden and the magic moment of putting on the glove that didn't fit. That's a big advocacy no-no.
Yep.
The same kind of thing with kids. If you don't care what your kid's answer to something is, then feel free to ask the question. But if you are concerned or don't know what the answer is going to be, then you shouldn't be asking your kid that question. And there are hundreds more corollaries that I've come up with and realized that my poor children have a prosecutor as a mom who basically cross-examines them and tries to get to the bottom and tries, you know, impeaches them and doesn't presume that they're innocent, though.
We learn to respect it. I grew up in a household where my father was a police officer, and now my kids are growing up with me doing what I do. And one thing that we see a lot of, in fact, there's a big press release here up in Canada, and I know you saw some in the States, and actually the European version of Interpol called Europol were involved in a huge prosecution sting of kiddie porn cases all across the world. One of the foremost experts as far as getting on the net and catching some of these scum, Stephanie Good, who's written a wonderful book, Exposed, has been on. She's also an attorney, has been on talking about this. And you talk about educating parents on how to prevent children from becoming a victim of the internet. This internet, well, without it, my show wouldn't be heard by nearly as many people as it's being heard by right now. But we also have a strong, devilish demon with this internet and all the garbage that are out there wanting to pounce on young kids, wanting to set them up. And it's people like you and Stephanie Good that get out there, and Wendy Murphy, that get out there and try and catch these scumbags before they do something, or prosecute them, sadly, after they do something. Tell us about your education that you work with the parents and the internet.
Okay, well, I do a great deal of internet safety and cyber safety prevention and education for parents. I think parents of this generation are extremely tech paranoid, whereas their kids are extremely tech savvy. You have, you know, 4 and 5 year olds who know how to navigate their way through the internet nowadays, and you have, you know, 30 and 40 year olds who, you know, if they check their email once, you know, a week, they feel like they're computer geeks. So what the idea is, my message is, I think the internet is a wonderful, powerful, amazing resource for people. And it's no different, you know, the crime and the risk is really no different than any other modern-day invention. I mean, if you go back and look in some of the historical roots of crime, you know, when with the invention of the car, they were saying everyone's going to hell in a handbag. I mean, you know, the telephone, people, you know, it increased the access for crime. So every modern invention is going to have a problematic side to it, and that's just the reality. But the idea is instead of, you know, burying your head in the sand, parents need to just get off their asses and learn about it. And really, the thing that I think that parents are so scared about is that it's so overwhelming, because there is so much information out there and so many websites and so much stuff that people just kind of turn off and say, forget it, I'm not going to bother, and assume that their kids are going to be safe. And what I try to really educate parents to do is, I believe every parent should have a Facebook account, a MySpace account. They should go on YouTube. There's Club Penguin, which is basically a MySpace for, you know, that attracts the 5 to 10 year olds. And if you get yourself on those sites and the parents get themselves on those sites, they'll figure out pretty quickly where the problematic parts are. Not to mention, if they are on those sites and make their kids add them as friends, they can be able to navigate and learn more about their kid than they would ever imagine.
You know, one of the things that I see here is that you work with junior and senior high school students with mock trials, and you talk about criminal cases, case summary statements, exhibits, rules of evidence, things like that, that the young folks in high school, juniors, seniors, whatever, must be fascinated with. But it also prepares them in life for, if a police officer or somebody ever did come to them and try to ask them for a statement, as far as to look to what to look for, you know, the old adage, keep your eyes and ears open, you know, keep your mouth shut until you're asked a question is one thing, but what you're doing with these high school kids is also great. Let's talk about that.
Well, first of all, it's incredible with, you know, the modern day television shows and Law and Order and Court TV and CSI, the interest in court and the legal system and crime is huge. And, you know, the fact that we can take that interest and the community's interest and channel it into a positive way where kids can actually have a skill. We're out there, out there doing something with this information instead of sitting in front of a television or a computer. They can work on their skills. You know, I kind of look at this as the modern day theater. Well, you know, if you can't sing or dance and you're not a sports player, then the courtroom's the place for you, and that was definitely me. And it's a place where you can have opinions and you can learn and you can question, and you are able to learn how to make logical arguments and have an appreciation for all the components that go into a case, because it's not the smoking gun that generally comes out in a real-life criminal case. And what's fascinating is how unbelievable, I mean, I was working with some kids at Oakwood School, and they were amazing in terms of the presentation that they did. They would embarrass, you know, many people on the criminal bar that I see out here.
Yeah, and exactly, and they are our future, and if we can work with them and get them prepared and even interested in something like this, it's a huge step. You know, when we look at these sorts of problems in today's society, one of the big ones is kids having kids. I'm sure you see it all the time when you're prosecuting cases, as far as the young folks having children that probably shouldn't have them. Again, flaws in the system, we've discussed that. What do we do? How do we prepare parents who have teenage daughters or teenage daughters that may be expecting for what's lying ahead of them? It's not that cute, cuddly little toy that you see in the movies. This is a living, breathing human being that's sadly are getting dropped off bridges today and not able to live the life that they were brought into world to live.
No, trust me, I had my daughter when I was 30, and that was when I realized you can't exactly stuff her in the, you know, in the drawer when you want to go out. She's alive. It's not a plant, you know?
Right.
And it's unbelievable how we don't have formal training for parenthood, yet we have training for just about everything. I mean, you have to go to computer, training for any, you know, measly job nowadays. What I think the number one thing is that parents and families and the community need to just provide these, you know, young moms and young fathers, for that matter, with resources. It's a places that they can go where they can handle whatever situation comes up. And I think the main thing is that camaraderie, where, you know, if you have a place where you can talk and vent through the issues, where you can be given resources and be given contacts and are not isolated, you have a much better chance of at least seeking out help when you are in that crisis situation. I mean, it's kind of the old AA adage, I think. I mean, yep. I think you need to be in a place where you have support. That's really where it comes from.
Yeah, absolutely. And without that, you're going to be in big problems. The book is Everything I Learned About Parenting I Learned in Court. Of course, Robin Sachs is a television analyst, current deputy district attorney with Los Angeles County. Always a pleasure, Robin.
Thank you. You too. Have a good evening.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This is Scared Monkeys Radio. My name is Dana Pretzer. On the 26th of January from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the mall at Millenia, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, there will be a safety and community event called A Beacon of Hope for the Missing. It talks about the Kesey family. Of course, Jennifer Kesey is a story that we've talked about on this program many, many times, and we haven't heard from Drew Kesey in a little while. We're going to take a quick break and come back with Jennifer Kesey, who is still missing, by the way. You can go to the webpage to find out more at www.findjenniferkesey.com to learn more about this disappearance. We're going to bring on Drew Kesey, Jennifer's dad, here in just a couple of minutes to talk about A Beacon of Hope for the Missing. We'll be right back.
It's the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. And now back to the show.
Okay, we're back. I didn't want to be here two years later. The 24th of January 2008, it'll have been 2 years since Jennifer Kesey went missing. On the 26th of January, there will be an event called A Beacon of Hope for the Missing. It's a community event with free fingerprinting, ID being done. It's for all age people. Local and state officials will be in attendance to speak and, build community relations, in this case in Orlando, Florida. Jennifer Kesey, again, has been missing for 2 years. I want you all to go to the webpage that talks about Jennifer's disappearance at www.findjenniferkesey. Kesey is spelled KESSE.com. Again, that's www.findjenniferkesey.com. It's been a little while since I've had Drew Kesey, Jennifer's dad, on the show, but we have him here tonight. Hi, Drew.
How you doing, Dana? Thank you so much.
I'm not trying to be flip when I say I didn't want to do the show tonight. I want to do the show because I want to do what I can to help, but it's been 2 years, and that's 2 years too long, and we'll get into that in a little bit. But you have an event coming up here, A Beacon of Hope for the Missing, a safety and community event. It sounds fantastic. It'll be on the 26th of January from 9 to 1 o'clock in the afternoon at the mall at Millennia. I hope I'm saying that right. Tell us a little bit more about it.
Well, again, we've felt such a need to give back to the community because they've been so good to us and really all over the country. But we've had the opportunity now to go beyond Jennifer. We wanted people to know that there's more than Jennifer out there, and we're really having four or five different families of missing right in Florida as well as across the nation coming in for the event. And we're also going to be passing out flyers of all Florida missing people that we can get our hands on, and just trying to make it more awareness that it goes beyond Jennifer. It is a problem not only in Florida but across the nation and in a lot of countries. And we do want to give back, and we thank the people for that.
Well, the strength aspect of this, and I've spoken to both you and your wife many times, and I can feel the hurt in your voice, but the strength to come and to give back after what you've had taken from you is probably the thing that's most admirable. I see that the police chief, Val Demings, will be speaking that day. Talk a little bit about the police chief and what the police department has been able to do to help you and maybe the status of the case.
Sure. First of all, Chief Al Demings is a brand new police chief, and we had the opportunity to meet her just 2 weeks ago. And we're very excited. We were very excited with Chief McCoy, and we wish him well. He has retired and moved on to another position. But we're really... Val Demings has really given us great support right off the bat, and a lot of things have changed, to be quite honest with you. It has become very much a multi-agency now. We do have Florida Department of Law Enforcement very much involved, as well as Orange County very much involved now. So we have probably 2 to 3 more times the people working on Jennifer now, and they truly believe that they will solve the case. Something is going to happen, and they truly believe we will have answers. We hope it's soon.
There's always someone out there that knows something. It's just coming forward to say something. And, of course, you have lines that, go to a lawyer, confidential lines to phone. It's just that one tip is all you need.
It's very, very true, and it's true in almost every case. It's amazing. I think the last time I may have been on with you, we were discussing Jennifer, and she was in the deck of cards that was coming out.
Yes.
Out of that deck of cards, believe it or not, within the 3 months that it's been, 3 murderers have been brought to justice, and they were actually brought to justice through 3 prisoners who used those deck of cards and called the 800 number and reported it. It is amazing. So, we can solve crimes. It does take an effort. It does take guts, to be honest with you.
Yep.
And we can make the world a better place if we really, really want to, and now's the time to do it because the world is changing.
Well, you know, and I see the attendees that will be coming. Kids Finders Network, Crime Line, Child Rescue Network, Westgate Resorts, Florida Department of Law Enforcement, like you mentioned, Someone Is Missing, Website Creation, First Baptist Church, Missing Children's Center, Orange County Sheriff's Office. It's an epidemic that I know that you and I wish that we could just wave our magic wands if they existed to make it stop. But sadly, every time we turn on the news, we're hearing about another story about another child that's gone missing, another child that's died, another child that's been killed. And we need to do, you know, this isn't just about children, it's about missing people. But we need to do what we can to help. If you had a message, Drew, for a young mother, a young father, a grandfather, whoever, that tonight finds out that their loved one is missing, what would that message be?
Act as quick as possible. Do not take no for an answer from any authority, and continue to do what needs to be done until authorities take you serious and act on what needs to be done. Just be the squeakiest wheel, be the loudest person, do not give up, and show the unconditional love for the one who has been taken or is missing.
You know,
the only thing I can say is that you have to, time is so much of the essence when someone first goes missing. And we're working on laws, by the way, Dana. We testified in front of a state congressional committee last week, and it sailed through unanimously. We're strengthening the missing persons laws. We're making the authorities accountable to get things into the databases that are available and should be in there. And we're collecting DNA, and we're making people collect DNA and get them into databases, because DNA is the future of crime solving. It's solving it every day, for the good and the bad. We're finding people who we have in jail that are being freed because of DNA, and vice versa. We're putting people in jail because of DNA.
And that's so important. And the resources. Nothing makes my skin crawl more or make the hair on the back of my neck stand up than when I hear politicians say, we can't afford to fund the DNA database, or we can't afford to put it. No. These are important, very important programs that we need to do what we can to help. Again, the Beacon of Hope for the Missing is a safety and community event at the Millennia in Orlando, Saturday, January 26th from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m., rear parking lot D2. And again, go to findjenniferkesey.com. Take a look at any information that you know. You can find information how to pass that on there. Drew Kesey, you know, my friend, I wish I could be standing there with you on the 26th of January, and you know you're welcome on this program anytime.
I thank you, and you will be, and please thank the monkeys too.
Okay, thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's Drew Kesey, and again, findjenniferkesey.com. Let's get some answers for this guy. He deserves them, that's for sure. That's it. That's tonight's show. I want to thank Robin Sachs, Wendy Murphy, Andrew Kesey for joining us. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. My name's Dana Pretzer. Thanks for joining us. Good night.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.